Welcome to Werewolf the Podcast. This is an extra podcast. Again, we're talking to an independent author. Again, we're talking to one of my favourites, Greg, great writer, and he's going to be telling us today about his second book and the reasons why he wrote it and all that kind of business. So, yeah, he's just a talented, fine fellow. So I'll let him get on with the reading. And do you know what? Buy it. It's dead good. Just buy it.
The vampire knocked at the door to the office out of courtesy and custom only. This office and all of the other rooms in the warehouse, along with the nightclubs and bars, would soon be under their own control. The negotiation had been short and sweet. Hand over the keys to your empire, or else. As things had transpired, it seemed that both the keys and the else was the order of the day, which was a shame and an inconvenience, but by no means a problem. The vampire's orders had been clear. The member of the crew, the manager who ran the London operation, was doing a good job, but had been there for way too long, far longer than the usual 10 years in a role the firm permitted for regional managers. It had come to light that the appearance of the man in this role was being noticed. Noticed because that appearance itself hadn't changed in the whole time he'd been there. He just wasn't aging. Questions were being asked. Suspicions aroused. There was no way the boss could permit any rumours about a member of the inner circle to pervade or attract any kind of attention. Theirs was a business which thrived on anonymity and going quietly about things without being noticed, without unpredictable complications. The boss had told the vampire to go to London and intervene. The manager's tenure in that great city was over. Reassignment was long overdue. In fact, that time had already come and gone. He should have left town, gone to New York as requested, and taken the new assignment, new post, and new territory which awaited him, details to be shared upon arrival. But he'd so far refused to leave. Word on the street was that this manager had gone soft, fallen in love, or so they were saying. Love! What room was there for love in this game? Well, none actually. None at all. And so the manager had put in a request for retirement. The vampire knocked again, a little harder.
Are you gonna let me in or what?
All right, just a fucking minute,
came the reply in a somewhat terse tone.
Just finishing something up in here.
The vampire looked over its shoulder at the muscle-bound human who stood behind it, keeping watch. This man's right hand was in his jacket pocket, clasping an unseen pistol. In his left he held what looked like the case for a pool cue. The man showed no signs of stress or emotion, even though the objective was the removal of a gangster who had been running a significant overseas operation for many years. A serious guy. But this man was used to difficult tasks. He'd taken the lives of many people and facilitated the death of many more in the line of work. It just went with the territory. But not usually somebody who was so big of a deal as this country manager. If there was the slightest grain of apprehension, it wasn't visible in that powerful frame or behind two glassy eyes that seemed to be somehow out of focus. The vampire sneered and the man responded with an incredulous shake of the head. They waited there together, aware of the five heavies who stood just a few feet behind them, but unworried by their presence. The vampire glanced at the familiar again and nodded, as though granting permission. Immediately, the familiar stepped forwards and grabbed the handle to the office door and twisted it, only to find the door was locked.
Are you kidding me?
Called the vampire.
You locked the goddamn door? Do you think that's gonna make me pack up and go home?
After a few moments of silence, a clicking sound pierced the heavily charged air, and the door's lock was disengaged. The familiar took half a step back and withdrew the pistol from his pocket, ready to use it without hesitation if needed. An opening door always carried an element of the unknown, of the risk of sudden attack. He glanced over his shoulder at the group of men behind him and adjusted his position so that he could see both the heavies and the impassive door. The door swung open, back into the office, and a man in his 50s, by the look of him, stood with one hand on the door and the other outstretched towards the middle of the office beyond.
"Come on, then. In you come,"
he said. Inside the dusty old office was a desk with a couple of chairs in front of it and not much else. It smelt of cigarettes and booze and old conspiracies and was very much as the vampire remembered it from the last time it had paid a visit to the London operation and this same manager. What was not the same was the presence of another man in the room whom the vampire did not recognize. This looked to be a respectable gentleman, maybe 10 years older than the manager appeared to be, maybe more. Well-presented, healthy-looking, but clearly worried. The chocolate-brown skin of his brow was furrowed below his close-cropped grey hair, and his eyes were like saucers, flicking back and forth between the familiar's gun and the vampire's inquiring eyes.
"Hello,"
said the vampire cordially.
"And who might you be, huh? Are you part of this meeting?"
The vampire extended its hand formally, and the man tentatively took it in his own and nervously accepted the greeting.
I'm...
He couldn't form the words, and he allowed a nervous grin to flash across his features. The vampire didn't smile at him at all. It just stared, waiting for him to complete his opening sentence. He wasn't able to do so.
"He's a friend of mine, that's all,"
said the manager.
"He's a fucking civilian, all right? A civilian. And he's just leaving."
The vampire shot the manager a disgusted look.
"There are no civilians in our line of business. You know that as well as I do."
The manager returned the stare, not with aggression, but with an impressive lack of fear.
"He's not in our line of business, okay? So you tell your gorilla to fuck off out of the way and you and me can talk shop, all right?"
He had a London accent, even though he'd travelled extensively in his life and worked in many different locations over the years. But he'd come back home to London a long time in the past, and his voice had settled right back into its native timbre years ago. The vampire scrutinised the man, who'd started to sweat at the temples.
"Is it true what he says?"
asked the vampire.
"You a civilian, huh?"
The man blinked twice, and his eyes suddenly changed, appearing glassy and unfocused. Without hesitation, he whispered that it was true, that he was just a friend, not involved in the business in any way, not even interested in it. The vampire continued to stare at the man for a few moments, and then quite suddenly said,
"Well, okay then, you can go. I believe you. Go on, get the fuck out of here."
The familiar stood aside, and the man glanced back at the manager, his eyes now regaining their usual sharpness and focus.
"It's all right,"
said the manager.
"Everything's all right. This is just business, okay? I'll call you later."
The man made his way out of the office and past the five heavies who all stood nervously just outside the door. He didn't run, but he did walk as quickly as his shaking legs would permit him to go.
"Take a seat,"
said the manager as he gestured to the chairs in front of his desk. He closed the office door before walking around to his chair and asking if he could get either of his guests a drink. The vampire said that would not be necessary, that they weren't there to drink. The manager sat in his chair and smiled at the vampire and its familiar, who'd put his gun back into his pocket, perceiving the level of threat had reduced somewhat.
"Well, all right then. I'm assuming you because you're taking the business on, am I right?"
The vampire nodded its head slowly in agreement.
"Okay. Well, that's good. That's good news. Did they tell you that I'm retiring too? Can't wait, to be honest. I've put my bloody life into this business for what seems like forever. I think I'm finally due a bit of change of pace, right? Bloody knackered. I mean, nothing's forever. Maybe I'll be back, you know, but for now I need to retire from this game. Smell the roses for a bit."
The vampire was smiling at him, but the manager couldn't quite read its expression.
"So what? You brought me a present? A gold watch? A Rolex, maybe.
The vampire grinned.
Yeah, maybe. Something like that. You want to invite your team in so we can all wish you a happy retirement together? We did bring you a gift. It's in that pool cue case that my associate brought in. It'll be nice to present it in front of the team before you leave, you know?
The man smiled back.
What, we're doing a handover now?
He asked.
Right now? A bit fucking sudden, innit? No time like the present,
said the vampire with a genial smile. The manager was destabilized, but he knew as well as anyone else just how fast this organization moved when decisions had been made. The manager called to his team to come and join them in the office for an announcement. One after another, they came through the doorway. The manager's leadership team. A combination of bouncer and enforcer. These were large, tough-looking men, with glassy-looking eyes and steel jaws. The vampire and its familiar stood up to face the group, the vampire now smiling the most charming smile imaginable. It gestured for the manager to come around the table so they could stand alongside one another, facing the group.
Now, you all know that I'm from back home, don't you? You could say I'm from head office, right?
It chuckled at the business analogy. The henchman looked uncomfortable.
Well, what you may not know is that your boss here, well, he's decided that now's the time for a change of lifestyle. It's time for him to finally reap the benefits of so many years of devoted loyalty to the firm, dedicated leadership of our operation here in the good old United Kingdom. Well, we're proud of him. Proud of his achievements. And you know what? All good things must come to an end, eventually. Isn't that what they say? And he's been here a long time. Yes, sir. Much longer than we planned, actually. In fact, he's been here so long that it's natural that people might start to wonder what keeps a guy looking so vital, so healthy, you know? So young, even. Almost in defiance of old Father Time. Nobody can really answer that question. But when somebody who runs one of our businesses starts showing up in publications, on social media, that kind of thing, with people calling him the Peter Pan of the club scene, mentioning how he seems to get younger every year? Well, that's publicity. And how do you all think we view publicity in our line of business?
The vampire paused and looked at each of the henchmen in turn, but they were all too nervous to speak.
Anyone?
Added the vampire.
I mean, you probably don't like it too much,
ventured a vicious and powerful-looking man with most of his hair shaved off.
Probably don't like it too much,
repeated the vampire. The manager had stopped smiling. He sensed a change in the vampire, and suddenly he didn't like where this speech seemed to be heading.
Probably don't like it too much. Well, I'm sure I could put it a little better myself if I was to try, but yes, that about covers it. We do not like publicity at all. Makes us nervous. Makes us vulnerable. Ultimately, it makes us weak, okay?
The men continued to take it all in, silently.
Well,
continued the vampire,
I'm partly here to educate you all in the ways of our business, at least the way we run things in the United States. You see, your manager here has put in a request to retire, which I think is a good idea, as it'll give him a chance to get away from familiar faces that aged in a different way than he's become able to. And I? Well, I'm going to take this business on, and I'm going to be here with you for a while, and I'm going to train up a new manager for you all. That manager will be with the business here for maybe 10 years, and then we'll move on. That's our model, you see. No more than about 10 years. Never as long as your own manager here stayed on. You could say he outlived his usefulness, right?
The vampire laughed, drawing a nervous murmur from the assembled group. Only the familiar and the manager remained silent.
So, retirement it is,
said the vampire. At that moment, the familiar picked up the pool cue case and clicked the clasps open.
We have a retirement gift here for the outgoing manager,
said the vampire. Everyone, including the manager, peered into the case to see what was in there, and to their horror, the familiar withdrew a heavy, glinting machete.
"Oh, hang on,"
said the manager, backing up as he spoke and bumping into his desk.
"I'm retiring. They told me I could retire. You said it yourself. I'm retiring."
The familiar handed the lethal-looking blade to the vampire and drew his pistol, pointing it in the general direction of the five henchmen, who all froze. The manager continued protesting.
"No, you can't do this. I've got a life to live. I've got a dream. I'm going to buy a little cottage in the Cotswolds and please, Alex, please, you don't have to do this."
The vampire placed its hand on the manager's shoulder and gently guided him into a kneeling position.
"Please, Alex, you don't have to do this. I'm in love. Please, just let me go. Even just for a few years, just let me go."
But the vampire wasn't interested.
"You should have taken the offer for reassignment. You really fucking pissed a lot of people off with that love story bullshit, you know?"
The vampire raised the sharp blade into the air and paused, ready to strike a killing blow. Glancing at the henchmen, the vampire said,
"In our line of business, we don't like publicity. And we don't like it when people turn into fucking pussycats either. You all work for me now, get it? I want each of you to remember that." "Please, Alex, please,"
begged the manager. The vampire snarled a reply through dangerous-looking teeth.
"You should have come to New York more often, you know. Nobody calls me Alex anymore."
Hello, ladies and gentlemen and others. Welcome to this special on Il Lupo 2.0, the second book that Gregory Alexander Sharp wrote about werewolves. And as you know, he's a very good writer. He just wrote one of the podcasts for the show, and it was pointed out how much better it was than mine, although he did use utterly six times. But, you know, we'll forgive him for that. We've spoken about Il Lupo and how it was structured and the description format for it and all that kind of stuff. I'm just going to hand over and get him to give us a little revision of Il Lupo and how it led into Il Lupo 2.0. Greg.
Thank you very much, Fen, and thanks for having me back on. And thanks for pointing out that I used the word utterly six times in episode 145. available for free wherever you get your podcasts. Just throw that out there. Il Lupo. So those of you that didn't listen to the first podcast or haven't read the book, it's essentially the story of two friends who haven't seen each other for a long time. They get back together after one of them, his father dies. And he needs a break. So they take a buddy trip to Italy, and they get up to all sorts of hijinks while they're out there, and they wind up being confronted with a guy called Telemaco Russo, who is accused of being a werewolf. And well, spoiler alert, in my books, werewolves definitely are real things. Okay. Yes. So Charlie Mortimer and Nick Frobisher, the two pals, they get wrapped up in this world of werewolves and lycanthropes. And there's a race against time and, you know, all sorts of jeopardy and thrills and stuff. And at the end of the book, ultimately, there is a question mark about how are we going to get Charlie out of the jam that he finds himself in. Within that story, and it's the gambit is kill or cure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we call it Il Lupo 2.0, kill or cure, and that's really where we leave the first book off, and that's really where we pick the second book up. And in fact, you know, the premise of the second book, it's on the blurb on the back of the book, so I'm not giving too much away here. In order to cure a werewolf, there are three options, right? option one is not available to them because of circumstance, and you're going to need to read the first book to get that. Mm-hmm. Option two is you kill yourself or have somebody kill you.
Which are a lot of guilt-ridden werewolves do in our stories.
They do, or they get killed.
Yes. Right.
And that ultimately cures them of their problem. The problem goes away.
Yeah, most things I find.
You know, but that is unpalatable. So the first one's unavailable. That one's unpalatable. And the third one is unimaginable, right? And the third option, and I was at one stage, I was going to call this Il Lupo 2.0, the third option, because the book is about the pursuance of the third option, which requires them to find a vampire, and there's a ritual that they need to go through, which ultimately results in the death of the vampire and the lycanthrope being cured. And of course, vampires tend to be unwilling participants in such a thing. So it's not an easy task. And that is the premise. That's the premise.
Great.
Of the
book. Yeah. Oh, I really like the disparity between, it's not really a disparity, it's just a difference, I suppose, between the two books. Your first book is a real book of introduction and understanding and the growth of friendships and everything like that. And your second book is amazing because it's like a non-stop thriller once we've learnt those characters and how they interact and stuff. Was that a specific thing that you wanted to do, write a thriller?
It was, yeah. And I guess with Il Lupo, I wanted to really, like being on a roller coaster, I wanted to really build it up slowly, get you to that.
Yeah, you did it fantastic. I mean, the way that you introduced the characters, and I think it was a buddy book the first book. You know, they were getting to reevaluate each other's relationships, get to know each other again and do all that kind of stuff and then move forward with that. And now we know where these characters are and how much they care for each other. Then we move into them actually being surrounded by lots of action.
Yeah. And, you know, in the first book, once that switch is thrown, if you like, once they find themselves plunged into this supernatural world, the pace in the first book suddenly changes gear significantly. And what I really wanted to do with this book was kick it off in that gear,
yeah, right,
and maintain that pretty much all the way through, and hopefully I managed to do that.
Well, you managed to add about five twists and turns to the first chapter, because I was read it and I got to the end of it and you got me.
Yeah. Well, the beauty of it, I used the word beauty, the trick to it, right, is that if you read this book, if you were to sit down, you know, and read this book end to end, there's a bunch of stuff becomes apparent to you towards the end and you're like, oh, I didn't see that. Hopefully you didn't see that. And if you go back and read the first couple of chapters, you get smashed in the face by it and you're like, oh, he's already told me this stuff. There it is. It's right there.
Yeah. See it. I did that. I won't go into details, but there was a lot of, I think I initially got halfway through the book before I went, oh, duh.
There it is.
Yeah, no, it's fantastically written. And I really like the way the 2.0 keeps you on the seat, edge of your seat, as it were. I was going to say the seat of your pants, but that's wrong, isn't it? Edge of your seat. That's the one. Yeah. Yeah. So why the usual antagonists, the vampires, why the witches, why did you not decide that you were going to use robots and xenomorphs and all the kind of creatures?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I think for all the reasons that we touched on in our first conversation about, you know, how did I get into this genre in the first place? And I suppose my heart is in those traditional antagonists. You know, I see, and I think Adrian touched on this when you spoke with him recently.
Yeah,
that vampires, when we were kids, were baddies, right? Vampires were baddies, and they've become.
Adrian said now they've become seductive boyfriends.
Yeah, you know, I'm not convinced that that's how we should view vampires.
Not really
appropriate partner material for your female children. You know, I'm not sure that's the way to think of them. And so I wanted, And actually, I should also position this too with Telemaco. With Telemaco Russo in the first book, I wanted a baddie that you had sympathy for and that you liked, that you thought there was something about him that was sympathetic.
I think you did really, really well with that, because that's an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? With the podcast, I get so many people come to me and go, why do I like him? He's an absolute bastard, but I really like him. And you did the same with Telemaco. You kind of like, you felt a bit sorry for him, even though he was only doing things to survive, you know?
Yes. Yes. Now, what I wanted in 2.0 was a bad guy that you fucking hated. and we've got Frankie, the vampire, in 2.0, and he's an absolutely despicable character. Horrid. He's got no redeeming features, and I'm like, there you go, that's what vampires are like. Really nasty.
Werewolves are nice, vampires are nasty.
And they only tear you apart if you get in their way on the wrong occasion, you know.
I think also with the vampires kind of side of thing is that there's already a depth of knowledge in your audience, isn't there? They do have an understanding of that character trait, that kind of thing that they're expecting to see. I think if you're introducing brand new monsters and characters into it, you've got to then kind of build up the folklore story behind them as well, haven't you?
Yes, you do. There is a sinister intent with vampires that everybody expects. We know it's there, you know, and it's no surprise that that they're kind of baddies. And as you say, if I was trying to create a new folklore from scratch, I'd have to take some of the pace out of the.
I never thought of that. You're dead right. You'd have to completely. You'd have to slow things down to put all that description in there, wouldn't you? Cool. Yeah. And it was good to see you bring. I mean, there was the witch, and the witch in this is of a bigger. She takes more of a part in this bit, but like, it was good to see that you bring in the witches and the curse of the werewolf as a thing back in, because every 50s film was a gypsy curse, wasn't it?
It was
nice to see that being brought back in. Why did you bring the witches more to the fore in this one then?
Yeah, well, again, I just wanted to...
Because she's a badass woman, really.
She's really hardcore. Well, there was an element to Agatha in the first book. There's a scene in the farmhouse
when
Vivian Blair, where you just get a little flash from her.
Yeah.
You know, she puts Frobisher back in his box and he shits himself, basically. He's like, oh my God, this old woman here has completely bested me. And she hasn't raised a finger. I'm now utterly frightened of her. Sorry, I just used utterly again.
I don't mind. By the way, we were joking around about utterly before because it was just a joke. So don't take it personally.
So what I wanted to do was explore that. Go deeper into it, and say, well, look, what happens if you push her buttons, right? Yeah. What happens if you think you've got one up on her, and what happens if you go toe to toe with her? And well, you're going to find that out if you read the book, and it ain't pretty.
Yeah, definitely. There is a sense of that. She comes across as a very strong, intelligent character. And you're like, I couldn't pass shit on her. She's just gonna tell me how it is, you know. Yeah. I like the development of the relationship between Nick and Frobisher as well, with the way that they, because the character roles seem to change slightly from the first book. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You've got you basically do have character change, don't you? They seem to change a lot in how they sense the world and who's actually doing well. Even though one's a werewolf, he seems to actually be doing pretty well.
Yeah.
I like the way that you structured that.
Well, he comes, of course, from a background where he's suffering with some degree of physical frailty and mental health issues. And this curse that's bestowed upon him somehow perfects him.
And he feels like, actually, there is a version of my future in which this is a good thing. And everyone's like, no, don't fall for that. This ain't good for anyone, right?
No. He does have a big choice to make, doesn't he? But we won't go further into that.
No, he does. He does, and he finds it quite challenging and quite difficult. Frobisher, on the other hand, you know, starts off as this ebullient multi-millionaire playboy, if you like, who is blindsided by events that take place around him. You know, there's grief, and then there's this sense of culpability about what happened to Charlie.
He loses all his security, doesn't he? He loses the safety of what he's had. There's no one there to protect him anymore. And I think it must be very difficult for someone who's been that way through life. Then suddenly, whatever you do is in scrutiny and under, you know, it must be very, very difficult. And I do like the way that you've transitioned the characters in that. It's been very, very good. Yeah, is there any more that you would like to give us about the book before we...
Well, there's a drunken karaoke. So anyone who listened to recent episodes...
Sounds familiar. I wonder where I stole that from.
There is a drunken karaoke. And I will inform listeners that the inspiration for that was, in fact, my university career, where I was rather partial to singing Tom Jones classics on stage whilst simultaneously drinking jugs of cocktail and, you know, having fun whilst doing it. So I did embellish that somewhat and put Frobisher through it. Frobisher, you know, he comes out of these situations
okay.
Bluffs his way through. His biggest problem is his penchant for self-medicating with drink.
Alcohol, you can see how that affects him.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people turn to such things as crutches when they get into a position they're not used to. I mean, he wasn't a little drinker when we first met him in the first book, was he?
No, and it gets significantly worse in the second book, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a bit in the office where he gets freaked out because there's no alcohol present.
Yeah, so for those that haven't read the book, Frobisher is the heir to a coffee empire and based in the City of London. And whilst he's off on leave, the CFO at the company starts motioning like she wants to muscle him out of the way and take over. So he goes in for a meeting, and rather than sort of prepping for his meeting, he gets drunk on gin and tonic and it all goes wrong. And there's a few episodes in this book where Frobisher, rather than giving it of his best, he hamstrings himself through basically gin. It's largely gin, it has to be said. He seems to have a weakness for that, and wine.
Was there a reason why we found ourselves deep in, is it the German or Bavarian forests at a gigantic lab at any point? Or is that harking back to the 50s, or is that just, you know?
Yeah, okay, so...
I won't give any more details about that, but I was just sat there thinking, you know, this is a scene from the 1950s films. I kept expecting, you know, a hunchback man to wander through the door and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And anyone who's watched any of those like Ghost of Frankenstein or House of Dracula type films, you know, there's always a mad scientist trying to cure a werewolf or cure Dracula.
Particularly mad.
Or bring the monster back to life or whatever. They're all completely nuts. So
alive!
I wanted to have a mad scientist. And for those of you that like a little doffing of the cap to classic werewolf lore, the mad scientist is called George Wagner, or Wagner, probably. Mm-hmm. And that is the name of the guy that directed The Wolfman 1941.
Yeah, by the way, I wrote a book about all the movies and I didn't spot that and I felt really dumb. So there we go. Yes, yeah, Wagner.
I've even spelt his name in a peculiar way, which is the way that director spelt his name.
Yeah, he didn't start off with a... with a capital, did he? He's like, his capital's either a G or an A halfway through or something, isn't it?
Yeah, so he went a stage further than I felt I was able to do. I spelt it with a double G in the middle, like he did, right. But I didn't spell it with a lowercase W at the beginning.
No, yeah, I think the actual director had a particular sort of thought of himself being very, very important. Yes.
Yes, I think he probably did.
Yes. Are there any more Easter eggs in it?
There are. The eagle-eyed among us will notice that Charlie says he's not like other guys, right? Straight out of the Thriller video. Yeah. Michael Jackson said before he turned into the monster in that. So that was one of those. There's a few, actually. The eagle-eyed will also have noticed in Il Lupo, Fredo Esposito was described as being a man who was pure in heart and said his prayers by night.
All right.
Indeed. Mm. So that was Wolfman 1941. There's a couple in.
I love stuff like that. I love stuff. When speaking to Adrian, he'd done a few Easter eggs in his that I hadn't spotted. I must try harder.
Yeah, well, you probably know them all when they're pointed out to you, I'm sure.
Yeah, but like it's like so obvious. I think in movies it's much easier to spot, like when you see like a mask from a prior movie in a film or something like that. You know, it's kind of easier to spot. I was reading a book today by someone who I'm editing, and they'd called the pilot of their spacecraft Pontius.
Oh, that's good.
Pilot, all right. And then I noticed that a lot of the characters that he's used are historical characters,
okay.
But he's kind of changed their job to kind of suit their name, which I kind of thought was kind of very clever. So one of the detectives is called Doyle, Conan Doyle. And I'm like, now I get it. So there's like loads of little references. Yeah. I thought, yeah, stealing that. I'm not stealing it, obviously, if you're listening, person who I'm editing.
Yeah. Inspired by it.
Yeah. But I thought Pontius Pilate. I was like, oh, that's really clever.
I like that. Oh, by the way, watch out for one of the characters in Il Lupo 2.0 gets described at one point as being a walking meatloaf. So that's straight out of American Werewolf in London for those that haven't.
Yeah. And it's also very descriptive because you think of Meatloaf the singer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And ironically, he's no longer walking.
No.
Just point that out.
Okay. I'm surprised that he's been able to walk for as long as he has, though, his size. Yeah.
Yeah.
So where are we going next? Is there going to be an Il Lupo novel 3? Are we going back in time, in front in time? Because I'd really like to hear about Telemaco's past. I think that would be an awesome one. Or what are the plans werewolf-wise, if you're having any? I know you're writing other books, but we'll get to those.
Yeah. So there are plans in this universe. So there has to be a third novel going forward in time. I am compelled to write another chapter in this story, absolutely.
Good.
For
good.
Sure. And I know how it goes. I know the content of it, and I know how it finishes too. Possibly before I do that, I've got a couple of prequels that I have a feeling I want to write, maybe as novellas. So maybe, you know, a bit shorter. I want to do one that I'm going to call The Witch of Scythian Blair.
Right.
Which will be a bit of Agatha's backstory.
Fantastic.
And that will have a werewolf in it.
Right.
So there will be a witch and a werewolf in that one. And I do want to do... I've considered doing a series of short stories about Telemaco Russo. I love that character. He's really good.
I think you could have him wandering through the world, having different adventures every kind of week, couldn't you? Do you know what I mean? Because he's a traveller. I suppose it was with what Adrian said when I spoke to him, like with his idea of a comic, you could have this particular character a bit like Dr. David Banner wandering through the world and ending up in shit every week, you know,
absolutely.
And write as many novels as you wanted. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that sounds good. And what else have you got in the pipeline then?
Yeah, so I'm working on a novel at the moment, which is not a supernatural thriller. It's more of it's got gangsters and love, loss, murder and revenge at its heart, and 1970s nightclubs.
Cool.
So
it's based in Miami, did you say?
I'm not going to use the word Miami anywhere in the novel, but it is.
Okay.
Yeah, well, it's in fact, I'm going to say it's more Florida than Miami, right? So there are two fictional towns in a peninsula the southeast of the United States. And one of those towns is called Ocean View.
Yeah.
The other one's called West Side. So,
right. Okay. Right,
these towns don't exist in Florida, but clearly it's a big peninsula in the southeast of the United States and it's boiling hot. Right. So.
That sounds good. I was speaking to Adrian about his writing, how he sits down and does his writing and stuff, he says that basically he has everything planned and structured in his head, and then he writes it down as though he's watching the movie in his head.
Yeah.
And I found that really interesting because when I sit in front of the computer, I don't have a clue what's going to happen next. I just wondered what your process is. Is it all built there? Is it all structured? Is it all ready to go? You just actually need to just type it into the computer?
No, I mean, I'm one of those guys that goes with an outline, and I try, broadly speaking, to stick to the outline as much as possible, but I don't really get too hung up on it if I don't. I do like to let it happen organically a little bit. Generally, when I sit down to write, I've got an idea about what I want to get out of that session.
Right.
But I don't necessarily know how I'm going to get there.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Right. So I know what I know how I want to exit this segment of the writing, but I don't know what's going to happen within it.
Do you actually envisage the picture of what's happening in your head, or is it like for me I don't really view what I'm writing. I kind of think what I'm writing and try and make it interesting. It was quite interesting to see someone else. It's made me wonder over the past few weeks how many different ways people can actually put down the written word. You know, it must be amazing to have that movie already in your head and just be able to write it down.
I've had a few different experiences. I am quite a visual person, so I do have images in my mind's eye of the things I'm writing about. When I was writing Il Lupo, I had this image in my head of a guy sat in a studded wingback leather chair in a library in a smoking jacket with a book in front of him, reading it.
Yeah. That's incredible, isn't it?
That was kind of, I had this image. I mean, and as you know very well, I didn't sit down and write that book in one go. You know, it was over 10
12 years.
12 years
in between.
Yeah. but I still had this guy in my mind's eye kind of reading the story to me as I was writing it. With the book I'm writing at the moment, it's very different. It is like I'm there. It's like I'm immersed. Not quite like a movie, three-dimensional in a way. Kill and Cure was quite movie-like while I was writing that.
Yeah.
I can relate to that for sure.
I've noticed with my writing on the podcast at the moment, it's getting, I used to be able to complete a lot of information and get through quite a lot within like one episode. And now the episodes seem to be longer, but they seem to have, it sounds weird, but less in them. But more detail. It's just a bit weird. And it was interesting to say that you have different ways in which you write, because I can write a short story and fit everything in within 5,000 words.
Yeah.
But last podcast was a fight scene, and that was 3,500 words.
Right.
Absolutely. You kind of sit there and go, how can a fight scene be 3,500 words? That must be as boring as hell.
Well, I can tell you how it can be 1,500 words on the professor and 1,500 words on Will, and that's like two fights within a brawl, and it's all, you know, that's virtually the whole episode. And it was enthralling. I mean, it really drew you in.
As I was writing it, it was kind of interesting because I wanted to show the two different styles of the characters, because the professor is this really hard seasoned warrior who has like this waltzy old fashioned dancing kind of fighting style, and then you've got the animalistic horror of the werewolf character. Yeah. And I really enjoyed the contrast in those two. But yeah, it was really interesting. And I think as I speak to more writers, I'm going to find it so interesting to see how, because I thought writing was you sat down in front of your computer and you imagined. What I didn't realize was there's so many ways in which that story goes from head to fingers. You know, it's kind of interesting. Yeah. It'd be mind blowing. So, is there any future things you'd like to share, or any particular? Because you've got your new website out and stuff now.
Yes, I do, and we can drop a link to that in the description. So yeah, that's just a place where I've consolidated a lot of stuff. I've got there's reviews on there. There's click-throughs to buy the books. You can even preview the Kindle books right there in the website. Works nicely on a mobile. It's based on the Google Blogger application, but I've sort of used that in such a way as to just make it a bit more of an immersive user experience for people who want to find out more about what I've done and what I'm doing, basically. And I've also got stuff on there about the podcasts. So there's a bunch of bits in there about Werewolf the podcast, and you can click on mini players within the site, and those will play you via Spotify. So you'll get the Spotify click through happening. So that'll register for you as a play or a download.
We're now Spotify, whatever that means. So that'd be good. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing that. It's very kind of you. And the professor and Simon de Montfort, it's what I really like about our interactions before I write a podcast is you'll come up with as many or if better ideas than me. So like I really like the interaction that I get with you, because it's very infrequent that you can share something with another writer and say, what about this idea? And then you come back again, but what about this idea? And I go, what about this idea?
You know, I mean, you can cut this bit out if you want to, Fem, but it might be interesting for listeners if any of who are enjoying having the professor as part of this story. How did it all come about? When the professor, we didn't have him as Simon de Montfort initially, did we?
No, it's your idea, yeah.
And we were coming up with a name for him, and he was Simon. And then it was like, well, what's Simon's surname? And a few episodes later, it was like, what about Simon de Montfort? Oh, hang on a minute, there is a Simon de Montfort. Oh, what if it is that Simon de Montfort? And that was kind of how it happened, wasn't it?
Someone sent me a message saying your concept and understanding of history is amazing, and I sent something back saying I have Wikipedia and friends.
yeah,
I felt really bad about that, but it was like I didn't know who the hell until you turned around and said Simon de Montfort, wasn't he a duke or something in the 1200s? I was like, I don't know. And then the character basically was born out of that, wasn't he? Yeah, do you know what I mean? It's history and going to the Crusades and all that. Yeah. I was like, wow, how did that happen?
And then the next big question was, why is he immortal?
Yeah, and yeah.
Episode one, you saw five them, folks, didn't you? The answer's there.
Yeah. I mean, keep listening. Yeah, the professor is a big part of it now, and I'm really enjoying writing his character. I'm really glad that you wrote the episode. It was really, really good, because I was so impressed how you basically just knew how the podcast should go. You kind of understood the way it was written, and that's just such a sign of a good writer. That's such a good like ghostwriting thing. Like when you sent it to me, there was this half heartfelt moment where I was like, oh, this is either going to be fucking amazing or it's going to be
awful.
And I started reading it, and it was like, this is what I would write. Obviously, your study of history was a lot better than mine.
Hashtag Wikipedia, yeah.
But no, it's turned out brilliantly, and I really thank you for that, and thank you as an actor and your wife as an actress as well. She plays Lucifer to a fantastic standard. Honestly, if anyone should sound like Lucifer, it's Dawn.
Yeah. I mean, there's something very sinister about sounding that nice.
Yeah, there is. That should kind of worry you if she speaks to you in the night. I'd be like, oh. Yeah, the big twists and turns coming up. Yeah, big twists and turns coming up. Yeah. Greg also has a short story out called The Bridge, is it?
The Bridge.
Which is really, really good. 5,000 words. Please go give it a read. I can cut this bit out, but there is a hint that you might be taking the professor down the podcast line. If you want me to stop.
Oh, yeah. So that is an idea that's in the works, which is having had so much fun writing episode 145, The Professor's Backstory, and, you know, exploring a little bit more, well, jokes, basically, a bit of comedy in there that I haven't really written in at that level into my novels, and certainly not my short story. That's quite hard hitting. And had some nice feedback. And Dee, my wife, said to me, you should do more of that. You should speak to Fenn and see if he's cool with you using this character, and maybe use him to do your version of Horrible Histories. And pick on the life stories of certain famous people from throughout history and tell their stories in the guise of the professor, and, you know, maybe get you involved to do some voice acting. So, you know, the roles would be
reversed.
Awesome. It would be a lot of fun. So that is quite possible. You know, whether I could commit to doing it every single week like you do, or whether it's like a summer series like we did last year on Pod by the Fireside. Yeah. Together, with the werewolf series, that was a lot of fun. So that could be coming to a podcast near you soon, folks. Keep an eye out for that.
Yeah, I think that would be good. And like, I was kind of thinking that maybe interweaving different narrative storylines between, because I really enjoyed when we did the episode in the looting the museum. I think it was 105 where we mixed narratives. I think that was quite cool, and I think that's something that.
Yes.
Movie would be quite good fun again. I also have to thank you for helping me out with getting us now onto the Spotify platform and all that kind of stuff. It's been an amazing journey, and to all you listeners out there, it has been an amazing journey for us. It's very difficult for us to really enjoy something as thoroughly as this and also think that it could become something great, and Greg really has helped me out with that, because he has business sense, which I don't. So it's quite interesting to run past things, past him, and him to go, don't be stupid, do that.
So, thank you.
I've got to thank you very much. And thank you for being there. It was a real weird making of a friendship. And I'm really happy that we've met and we're cracking on with each other. Because it's, when I get a message off you, it makes me smile every single time. Well, I get message off most of my mates, and it doesn't make sense. So
that's very, very kind of you to say.
Buy his stuff. All the links are down in the description. Go buy his stuff. I can't say I read a lot of really bad writers, okay, and he's not one. Go read it. And thank you very much, Greg. And have you got any last, that sounds bad, doesn't it? Final words?
Any last words?
Any final words? What? Am I going?
Well, no, I just want to say thank you to you for the opportunity to be involved in Werewolf the Podcast. It really is mind-blowing to me that this time last year, you know, I was just becoming a listener to this podcast, and here I am, 12 months later, able to help you out, quite regularly, and write some bits here and there, and to help you with the things that you're doing on it. And it really is a privilege and a lot of fun. And, you know, we have a great time together kicking this stuff around. So I just want to say thanks as well to the listeners to Werewolf the Podcast for supporting you and supporting the show. You're an amazing crowd. Hopefully
some of you are a bit scary though.
some of you are pretty wild, right? But what do you expect?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You're a bit scary, but I love you for that. You're fantastic. Thank you for listening. You're wonderful. And we're going to continue with the exploration with some writers. It's next month, isn't it? God, I'm stupid. So I will leave it at that. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. And I'll leave Greg to say his goodbyes.
It's good night for me. Thank you very much.
And good night from him. Goodbye.